Would you start by telling us where you grew up, under what circumstances, and what your parents were like, and your childhood?
Why don't you start that?
Well, I was born in Scotland, in Edinburgh, Scotland, just after the end of World War II. My father was in the British Army Medical Corps. He was a South African, born South African, who had done his first medical degree at the University of Cape Town, and he wanted to specialise. And in order to do that, you had to go abroad. But because he was a Jewish South African, his options were relatively limited. He was given the option of Ireland, where he went first, and then subsequently he went to do obstetrics and gynaecology in Edinburgh. And the war broke out while he was beginning his studies, and he joined the British Army, and he was demobilised there. And to cut a long story short, that's where I was born. And I think my parents had hoped that they could stay on in Britain after the war, and having fought in the war, my father felt British. Except that very soon after the war, it was made clear that the colonial servicemen were to be repatriated back where they came from. And at that stage, my parents were already aware that South Africa's future was complicated, to say the least. And I think they were reluctant to go back, but they were put on a ship and went back. So I was, I think, 10 months old. And we landed up in post-World War II South Africa and went to one of the places where there was an opening for a young medical doctor, unspecialised, because that had gone with the war. And we landed up in Port Elizabeth, which was, as we used to say, one of civilization's outer fringes. It was sort of the Detroit of South Africa. It was very industrial. It served a large farming hinterland. It was pretty provincial, and it was a strange place to go up, of course, highly segregated. But it was close to, because of this industrial periphery, it was close to quite an active black community involved in various forms of unrest during the time I grew up in the early 50s and so on. So it was an interesting place in many ways, but peripheral. And my father was a local doctor, and we grew up in a relatively sheltered world. The center of gravity for teenage culture was America. It sort of was beginning to reach us across the Atlantic, you know, rock music, a kind of sense of a world elsewhere. But it was a world of apartheid and segregation, and it was, in a sense, retrospectively an interesting place to grow up in and probably shaped a good deal of what we became. But it was extremely problematical to find a political place. Our parents were of a generation where they had seen a war, experienced racism in Europe, and they were very afraid of what it was, the consequences would be to speak out in South Africa. So they were afraid, they were unhappy with the circumstances. They did what they could to kind of address them, but they were also terrified of being politically visible. And so for young people with a political sensibility, it was not easy.
Gene, I think we need to move your recording angel.
Okay. Yes. We'll put the recording angel here. Let him record history from below. I was born in South Africa, in Cape Town. I may just be the world's first baby boomer, since the baby boom is held to start on the 1st of January 1945, and I was born on the 1st of January 1945, at 7 a.m. in South Africa, which is more or less midnight in New York. I was a midnight child. My parents, my mother's family, classical Jewish Lithuanian background, like many anthropologists from South Africa. My father's family was from the Ukraine, immigrated to England, and during the Depression of the 1890s in England, went as a labourer, actually, with Rhodes's Pioneer Column to what was going to become Rhodesia, in the employed British South Africa Company, eventually also landed up in Cape Town. My parents grew to adulthood during the war, very much in the penumbra, the very dark penumbra of the Depression of the 1930s, and of course the Holocaust, of which they were acutely aware and, as Jean says, very afraid, because it visited South Africa in the form of the rise of the first national government in 1948, whose first prime minister, D.F. Malan, was quoted as saying that had the Axis powers won the war, the final solution would have been applied in South Africa. So they grew up in the wake of a fear of anti-Semitism, deeply closed Jewish community and very, very Zionistic. And I grew up in Cape Town in an environment which really was, as you were saying, the height of the dark years of apartheid. A very violent society, was radicalized, as many people were in our generation, by the Zionist socialist movements, which were more socialist than they were Zionist at that time. At least the youth movements were, the adult movements were more Zionist than anything else. But where a lot of South African scholars actually got their training in basically leftist social theory.
There was an interesting aspect of the story, and that was that there was a real gender disparity in the way in which white middle classes responded to the circumstances. Both of our mothers were much more radical than our fathers.
Very much so.
The fathers had the sense they had to be breadwinners, they had to put their shoulders to the wheel. They didn't like the circumstances of the politics in which they lived. And my father, who was a doctor, used to run what were called pro-deo clinics for down in the African hospitals that were under doctors and so on. And he did his bit. But they were, and they would fulminate about politics and so on, but they didn't really want to draw attention to their protest. But
the mothers didn't want us to be involved. This was taken as an embarrassment to them personally. But the mothers were much more.
Yeah. Now, my mother actually was born a Lutheran, and she converted to Judaism. But because she came from a German family, she had an aptitude for learning Yiddish, and she had roomed in London during World War II, where she had been before she married my father, with an old Jewish woman, and she spoke Yiddish perfectly. She had a wonderful sense of the idiomatic use of the language. And when we went back to this very small town, and this was Port Elizabeth, on the periphery of everything that had happened in the world, she got herself involved doing things, both working with a local elderly Jewish community. Many of them were German refugees. We spoke Yiddish, and the old ladies would always ask for her. But what was more significant was that, unlike your mother, who was a Zionist socialist, my mother was in that part of the Jewish community that believed that you started with political work at home. And they went into the townships in this big industrial city and ran soup kitchens and night schools and so on. And many of them got into political trouble, and there was constant friction between the fathers who would say, don't draw attention to yourself. You know what's going on in Europe. We're Jews here. We're not secure, There, but for the grace of God, just draw in your horns. And the mothers say, I would come home from school and there would be no lunch. And my mother would say, somebody came to the door and was hungry. You've got plenty to eat. Your food is gone. Tomorrow there'll be food. There was a sense in which they were much more engaged in the immediacy of the circumstances. And the gender differences were very strong,
actually.
And that was true in many communities. Nadine Gordimer has that wonderful story, A Chip of Glass Ruby, which is about the Indian community, where there was a similar sense of the obligation of the fathers to work within the system because they had to put food on the table. And the mothers having that sense that they couldn't bear it. And they saw it often through domestic labor, through the conditions of their own domestic servants, the connection with women who used to come and beg it in the streets, who obviously couldn't feed their children, and there was a real sense of empathy.
But there's another side to this, actually, from an anthropological point of view, because this community was deeply tied or produced into the anthropological community, a lot of people. My father was in the furniture trade. He was a small trader. Two blocks away was my Fortis's brother selling the same object, furniture as well. Oh yeah, absolutely. Isaac Shapira, who later became our teacher.
Inland traders.
Same area where Gene's family were. And when he moved to Cape Town, he spent his weekends away from school with their family. Until the day he died, he constantly asked after Gene's uncle, who lived three blocks away in London, although they never interacted. It's really strange. But there was this very strong connection of South African, most of them Jewish, but South Africans who went into British anthropology and became, every time we saw Meyer Fortis, his first question was, well, what's the news of the furniture trade in Cape Town?
And even into the next generation, David Lamb
comes
from a similar kind of family. But, it was a case of being, in a way, the dominated fraction of the dominant class, right? Yeah. It's a kind of displaced elites, which is what anthropologists often were. And on the colonial fringe, I think. And that's where anthropology, when we went to university, as first-year students, I always say, I had no idea what I wanted to do. So in the first year, I did courses that started with A. I did Afrikaans archaeology and anthropology, and I thought I'd move to B
history,
the next year.
Art history. Actually, Jean was planning on finishing her BA in 2017 with zoology.
But in the anthropology classroom, and with Monica Wilson, the late, lamented, famous anthropologist in Southern Africa.
The greats of the generation, actually.
This was the only place where you actually saw some kind of reflection of the fact that you were living in Africa, and that African society and African knowledge had something to teach the world, right? And it was an extraordinary experience, because in your English literature classes, you were taught English literature. There were no writers in Africa that were worth mentioning. You know, even in South Africa, they weren't. But there was something about, and there was a resonance. And again, our first teacher, Monica Wilson, was a woman whose husband, Godfrey Wilson, had committed suicide under difficult circumstances in Zambia as a conscientious objector during the war. And she was a woman, and her whole relationship to South Africa on the one hand and ethnography on the other was very much formed by, you know, that generation and the experience in this place. So it was a very interesting set of interconnections.
It was. They were also deep. Monica Wilson herself was deeply liberal. In fact, it's now because there's an industry in South Africa writing Monica Wilson's biography, and she turns out to be a very interesting character. And as interesting, of course, was Godfrey, her husband, who committed suicide, as Jean said, who was a radical way before his time. In the 30s, he was writing about African African proletarians in a way that really was to anticipate world systems theory. It's quite prescient. Reading him now is almost it's almost spooky, the extent to which he anticipated a lot of Marxist theory, a lot of economic anthropology of the left. But what was interesting about the School of African Studies in those days, anthropology was in the School of African Studies, along with archaeology and African languages, was it was the only place on the University of Cape Town campus that was licensed to have black and white faculty together. So this was and what is more, this is a period, 64 to 66, the period of the sabotage trials, the rise of Kontuwasis, etc. It was a very strange moment.
Very repressive.
It's very hard to explain to our students what it was like growing up in a fascist educational system, because under South African law, anybody who'd had any connection, unspecified what that connection was, with a communist party, basically with anything to the left of Attila the Hun, was deemed communist, and that meant that people could be summarily relieved of their jobs. And this happened to a lot of our teachers. Jack Simons, who was the other department's comparative African government and law, and Jack Simons, who was a hero on the left in South Africa, wrote a brilliant book called Caste and Colour in South Africa. He in fact trained many sort of well-known South Africans, L.B. Sachs, the great legal protest generation, etc. He was summarily banned during our second year. Simply, one day he wasn't there. And this kept happening around the campus. Lots of people, and we were, of course, out of the classroom as much as we were in it, the street protests on campus, which was a very strange, very repressive era. And, of course, many of the books we teach now take for granted were banned. There wasn't a single text by Marx. There wasn't a single... Peter Worsley was banned. It was amazing.
Ronald Frankenberg.
Frankenberg was anything that had any hint of socialism, communism, etc. So if you wanted to, and you could get access to books, you had to go and sit literally in a cage on the fifth floor in the library with a pencil while there was a security person who watched what you were doing, so you couldn't take anything out. It was a very strange, strange world. But anthropology in that world, as you were saying, seemed to have a resonance with contemporary South Africa like nothing else did. It wasn't a radical discipline. But it created a space in which one could think radical thoughts and from which one could ask questions about the nature of South African society, which was almost impossible anywhere else.
Monica Wilson already in 1951 had written a paper called Which Beliefs and Social Structure, which was published in the American Journal of Sociology. And it was a brilliant insight. It was structural functionalist and as insightful as anything, comparing two African societies around the different idiom of which beliefs. But the end of it was a direct reference to McCarthyism in America. Raising the question, is witchcraft simply an African phenomenon? It was so ahead of its time. She was also writing books with titles like Reaction to Conquest. And she saw anthropology as part of a colonial encounter and aftermath. And it was interdisciplinary. It was also always hitting at where apartheid touched ground. So, for instance, she was involved in the Kaiskamma Hoek survey, which is a survey of Eastern Cape poverty, right? Which actually looked into the conditions of what this racially segregated society meant for ordinary people, for nutrition levels, for life expectancy levels, that sort of thing. And it was quite extraordinary and unprecedented anywhere. And also it was a world in which Africans spoke. Through the texts of ethnography, through the collaborations with these studies and so on, there were people who spoke about this world. And it was a world that was unfolding around you all the time. It was mute. So that there was a lot of protest, but it was always mouthed by white theorists or white activists. and African voices were really, you know, sort of almost inaudible. And the anthropology world was one where that was different. So it was really
also, as it turned out, she had a very strong sense of herself as part of an anthropological couple. So when we were engaged, when
we met in anthropology.
Yeah, we met in one of her classes actually, and started arguing then. And, she sort of took us under her wing. There was a deep sense of identification. She, you know, they'd been very much an anthropological couple, had written together, etc., which of course we later went on to do. She had done a kind of historical anthropology. She was editor of the Oxford History of South Africa, co-editor with Leonard Thompson. We went on to write about, you know, historical anthropology. Jean wrote about ritual in ways I think that she was very proud of, actually. So there was a very strong genealogical link with her. I mean, people often say to us, oh, well, you're products of the Manchester School. We weren't, not at all. I mean, we worked in the Manchester School in Gluckman's very last years, although he was then no longer the head of department. He was an Upfield professor, a research professor, Emrys Peters was. But we happened to fit into that world by virtue of the things we were doing, Jean Moore in sociology with Peter Worsley and Clyde Mitchell.
Well, there were nepotism clauses at that stage where husbands and wives could not be
in the same department.
I worked in the medical school.
But also, you had a strong, I mean, Peter Worsley was, was a close friend and a wonderful, he was a wonderful pedagogue to us in our early days. But
Terence Ranger was there too.
Terry Ranger was there, yeah. It was a wonderful, I mean, Manchester in those days was an extraordinary place. It was really vibrant. It was frankly oriented against the South, right? It saw itself as existing in opposition to Oxford, Cambridge, and London, which is kind of fun if you were there. You know, you had to have something to. Gluckman's own image of the world was a soccer league, in which, of course, we were Manchester United.
Gluckman was also South African.
Oh, yeah.
And married to a well-known leftist. So that while he had family who were very involved in Israel, the Attorney General and
his younger brother was the first Attorney General.
And a brother who was a journalist on the Jerusalem Post.
And his sister married my cousin.
John Scott. These are very incestuous relationships anyway. But the fact was that he was very, so he'd been a Rhodes Scholar, but he was assertively a red brick northern person. Although, of course, between those two periods, we went to the London School of Economics. And that again was Monica Wilson, who said, for you, maybe not Cambridge. We never quite knew what she meant.
We knew exactly what she meant, actually. But
the LSE, and that was formative because we were there in the late...
In 68.
In 67, 68. And this is where our major company, because we were put into a class. If you came from outside of the British system, you didn't move directly into a graduate program with a BA. You had to go on to a kind of...
Remedial year
where you took courses and then wrote an exam and you either passed, or there was just pass-fail, right? You either went into the PhD program or you were sent back.
Pass was an upper second.
Yes. but our company in that class were all draft dodgers from the US, right? So there was a very particular kind of political and environment there. When we first arrived at the LSE, Mick Jagger had been in living memory a student there, right? And was still holding concerts on campus to support the sorts of ferment of youth culture in the late 68 when there was things done in sympathy
with the
Parisian uprising and the anti-war in Vietnam and so on. And Jagger and his band then, who, you know, we were just beginning to really make waves in Britain, used to raise money for the Socialist Society, the LSE, and this was all going on while we were there.
The whole ferment of Europe, I mean, 68 was happening, the LSE was closed for most of our first year there. The anthropology department decamped to the Royal Anthropological Institute
in Bedford Square.
But we spent most of our time in protest. The Great Grosvenor Square March, the anti-Vietnam moment.
That was before the LSE was purged. It was then quite a radical place. Mm-hmm. Remember when I first arrived outside, it's now no longer an open street with traffic, but in front of the main building in Houghton Street, you would walk, the big black cabs would come around the corner very quickly. And I was just walking across the street, and this cab nearly knocked me over. And as I leapt onto the sidewalk, he said, he looked up at the school, and he said, if you want to be red, you've got to be quick. We were literally playing chicken with the students who all seemed to be,
If only.
Members of the left.
But they were very interesting. Those are the moments also that anthropology, for the first time, was developing arguments about colonialism. After all, Talal Assad's book, The Anthropology of the Colonial Encounter, was going to come out in 73. But a Marxist anthropology was beginning to identify itself, which it hadn't before, and as former colonials, as Jean said, you know, this is very much the sort of Alberto Memmi moment, where you are the dominated fragment of a dominant class, but you do understand, by that token, you do understand that you're not British, you're not Black African, you're caught in a strange middle ground.
Yeah, everybody's weird. I mean, when we were at the LSE, they still had Firth's original collections of field notebooks, and Malinowski's cooler objects were in a glass case in the seminar room, right?
On the fifth floor.
And we would be sitting there when there weren't seminars, the famous Friday morning seminar. You'd be sitting around with other graduate students. There were people like Joel Kahn and Jonathan Friedman. I mean, people who were going to become like the founder members of Marxist anthropology. And we were all sitting there, various expatriates, you know. And we'd go out and hear somebody like Tariq Ali giving a radical talk about the nature of the war. And then you'd come back into this hallowed environment with the pith helmets and the cooler objects and sit around the table and talk about field work with Lucy Mayer, who still believed that facts and values had to be separated. I mean, it was very, very
Danny Convent was on campus often, as you said, Tariq Ali. It was, and there were, of course, a lot of South African anti-apartheid figures who'd either had to leave the country or left the country just in front of having to leave it.
Robin Blackburn, who Robin subsequently left and came to the New School, was one of the young faculty leaders. I think he was young faculty leader.
Yes, he definitely was. And of course, at the same time, the new left was beginning to form around economy and society, etc., etc. So they were very interesting days and had a major impact on the way we were going to think about the world.
Anthropologically, I mean, Alfred Gill, you know, the late Alfred Gill, who died so tragically so young, was such a brilliant inventive anthropologist, and he was part of this group. So it's interesting because he, for instance, came from quite a sort of intellectually aristocratic background, but the LSE was this place of ferment, and you had to be in a big city to be able to feel this. This is what I've always felt about a certain kind of anthropology. You know, it's you need to be in the city to feel these kinds of things.
As a student body, we actually was quite interesting.
The winds of change were felt on campus.
They were, and we were all going to experimental theatre and all talking about this stuff, and there was a real sense of the empire beginning to strike back. African theatre, South Asian theatre, movies, etc., etc. And in a way, it was quite an extraordinary opening up, because anthropology, at least in the universities, has tended to be quite insular in many of the places we've taught over the years. It certainly looked that way at Manchester when we first got there. It changed during the 70s radically.
But African studies was always a little different.
Yeah, but this had a real sense of engaging with London, which of course was in its own 60s fluorescence in an extraordinary way, and that certainly was going to affect what we later did.
Yeah.
By the time you arrived at Manchester, we were already pretty clear that you were going to be doing field research in South Africa.
We'd already done it.
We went from the LSE.
Yeah, yeah.
And again, it was Monica Wilson who smartly said to us, if you want to do field work in South Africa, work near a border, because you can't really do field work under apartheid conditions. You will eventually be thrown out.
Which we were.
So work somewhere where people straddle a border, and it'll be interesting because you can look at the same sort of cultural legacy under two different kinds of, you know, state formations. I mean, she was extraordinary. And that's impressive. Exactly what happened.
And that's what we did. And in fact, she said to us, ask Shapira, who became my supervisor. He became your supervisor later for a peculiar reason. But he was about to retire. But he managed to get us a research permit, which was basically impossible, because there was a permanent secretary, I think it was, in the embassy in London, who'd been a student of his. And he wrote to this guy, I don't even remember his name, it's an Afrikaans character, who'd been, I think, did a diploma at the LSE or something, but he'd known him. Maybe in the old Bechuanaland days, but he knew this guy. And that's how we got our research permit, because nobody was getting research permits. But Monica had the prescience to say then, you may have a research permit, but that doesn't mean to say you're going to finish your field work.
We did, actually, but barely.
But barely.
And when we went back to, you know, really follow up, we went to the other side of the border.
Yeah. But after 19 months, when we left because we were very sure we weren't going to be. A security person seemed to be looking at us very closely. All kinds of stuff happened. Which
it was impossible doing field work.
Yeah, it became, and it just we got the sense that if we didn't move, we would be moved. In fact,
but you were also putting people that you spoke to
at risk.
It was incredibly difficult to do. And it brought you very close to people. I mean, we are still in touch with friends that we worked with there who were our own age, Botswana, local teachers, intellectuals involved in underground politics, and their children, whom we still see.
Yeah.
We're now in touch with our children.
Right.
So it's been a long connection,
delay,
but but it was very difficult.
But we were lucky in one respect. We had two or three members of the white community. One who had been a former Sharpeville detainee who ran the local paper, a man called Joe Podbury, who's recently died, whose sister actually is a very famous South African who was basically forced into exile, and a man called Bruce Little who ran the local pharmacy. And they told us what the police were asking about us and things like that, especially Bruce Little. Remember, he would tell us what was being said and so on, which helped us a fair bit. Also, Simon Roberts, who was at the LSE and with whom I subsequently wrote both papers in the book, who was in the Attorney General's office just after independence in Botswana, had access to ways of moving material. We actually gave him our field notes and he looked after them because we were always afraid that they would be taken, etc. And Simon became a lifelong friend, but in fact we were recollecting recently how he took our field notes from us.
But we also had a lot of collaborators, friends in the black community, particularly people in the church, which was always a refuge for politics there, and I was working on churches. I had been, of course, I left the LSE assuming that I was going to study traditional religion, right? Because Christianity was what historians or sociologists or comparative religion scholars did. But when I got there, this was the kind of idiom of life, right? But it was a very particular kind of Christianity made under local historical conditions. But several of the leaders of the churches, they were extraordinary people who were involved in everything from feeding the hungry to, you know, one of them actually being the priest for Robert Sobukwe, famous struggle detainee.
A man called Chipupa.
And he took us actually to be ritually treated by a local healer very soon after we got there to protect us against the security police. So we had all kinds of... But the most significant thing there was that in terms of the story that I just told, that the kind of structural functionalist methods and theoretical armature that we left the LSE with at this point in the late 60s just were kind of totally inadequate when we got to this world, where you couldn't separate religion from politics, you couldn't separate ethnography from the structure of the whole apartheid colonial state. There was no way that you could see these things as not a product of a very large history. And the border, in a sense, was both there and not there. So it forced us into a kind of anthropology that it was difficult to write when we got back to the LSE, and some of that stuff was put on hold until we started writing our own books and were in independent jobs. But it was an amazing forcing ground. It also very early got us working with other scholars, as John has said, Simon for instance, and others who were working on a new kind of social science in South Africa. And that was a saving grace, because even where anthropology wasn't interdisciplinary, as it wasn't initially in Manchester,
certainly wasn't.
There were these comrades who worked together and read each other's materials and so on, and just pulled you into another mode of thinking altogether. So it was interesting.
So were South African anthropologists in general aware of the fact that the structural functionalist model was lacking?
And became kind of quite a little bit after this. There was a period of complete kind of freeze in the sense that it was impossible to know what to do, right? Because you couldn't do field work, really. Mm-hmm. We couldn't have gone to this place to do field work if we hadn't come from a British university. Mm-hmm. From a South African university. We had never got permission. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't have had the confidence to even think it was possible, right? But very soon after this period, what happened was that those who actually felt that anthropology had to somehow make itself relevant to this world began to read social history and began to do what was kind of sort of political economy, Marxist social history, kind of E.P. Thompson-inspired type of history out of people like Schiller Marx and then Terence Ranger, the new history school of the history workshop.
That's right. I mean, anthropology in the later apartheid years was eclipsed by social history. And even we were drawn into the social history world. I mean, we taught this Africanist, it was a history and anthropology seminar with Ranger, who became a close friend of ours, close colleague in Manchester. Historians like Colin Bundy and William Baynard became our interlocutors.
We worked
much
in the inter-apartheid movement together.
Yeah, that's right. We worked in the inter-apartheid movement together in Manchester.
In
fact, Gene and I and Colin Bundy and a man called Zola Zembe, who was a unionist, actually formed the anti-apartheid in Manchester, and that took up a lot of our time. Also, a woman called Melody Mtezuka, who was a social worker. And we got very involved with the British Labour Movement and the boycott, etc., etc. So it was a lot of political work that also bound us to that group of historians. And they became our much closer interlocutors. After it wasn't fashionable to do historical anthropology even then in England. It was sort of slowly edging into more into the discourses of the left than it was into mainstream anthropology. Of course, American historical anthropology was a different creature entirely and had very little to do with us. It was much more cultural, whereas we were socio-cultural anthropologists. We were probably too cultural for British anthropology and too sociological for American anthropology and too historical for both. Which wasn't a very comfortable place. But Manchester, because of these interconnections with Ranger, with Bundy, etc., etc., was a comfortable home in which to have uncomfortable arguments. And I think that decade, was almost a decade, was deeply formative for both of us, because I think...
Yes, because there were also differences with historians.
Oh, deeply.
Lots of differences. I mean, there was much more of a kind of... somewhat fixed set of Marxian expectations as to how you explained colonialism and its determinations at the local level. Right? And there was a concern, for instance, with consciousness. And we already then were working with models that were, they didn't assume that everything that people thought and that motivated their worlds were about consciousness. I started to read Foucault at this point because I was working in medicine and religion. And I got very interested in forms of embodiment and subjectification And so there were interesting tensions there about the degree to which ethnography could generate truths that were not simply written in the blueprint.
Yeah, we'd have monumental arguments.
Kind of assumption of colonialism unfolding and colonial capital and racial capital unfolding and so on. That was there, but we were also very interested in what was particular
about
the African scene, right? And the South African scene, and about the local reactions to proletarianization and
also,
what that meant for kinship and these kinds of things.
Exactly. I mean, that last one is critical. I mean, I remember having a monumental argument with some of our very close friends on just this, where they'd say, well, that kinship stuff, that's all superstructure, that's what anthropologists do. And we'd say, but how do you actually think you understand a relation of production in Africa that isn't, in some sense, articulated through the idiom of kinship? To talk about matrilaterality or patrilaterality is not talking simply about an idiom, it's talking about a material set of relations. So if you want to come and understand anything like African quotes modes of production, let alone process of articulation, you don't understand that stuff, you don't understand anything. All you do is get very abstract forms. And of course, life in colonies isn't about abstraction. Abstraction is violence. So we would have these kinds of arguments the time.
It came to the head particularly around the work I did for my PhD, which is about churches and resistance. Right? And it turned around the whole question of what constituted political subjectivity, resistance, agency. And I was very concerned with the fact that the world that we found, particularly on the ground in the Northwest where we did our fieldwork, was one where people were living in tension, but also in some form of collaboration, which is where the Gramscian model kind of came in, with this regime. And I was very aware of the fact that there were ways in which they were creating spaces for themselves, creating senses of autonomous worlds, of meaning, of significance, of action, of independence, that were not political in the sense that they were paid up members of any one of the formal movements, but clearly were iconoclastic in significant ways, and were reforming the world, and they did this through the idiom of what the church has provided. And so I got into these arguments about to what degree was this form of action, resistance, to what degree was this something which was political, with a small p, and how did we have to rethink the margins between the religious and the political, for instance, around these, or the symbolic, and the consciously ideological. And those sorts of questions were very much at the fore of these of that period.
John, what were you working on when you were working in the church?
Well, Jean has a wonderful line which is absolutely true, which is, so anthropology was deeply gendered when we were at the LSE. So she got religion, I got politics. It really was, and the LSE didn't entertain any possibility about doing a PhD together. We raised it, and this was just... The model of the individual author, the kind of heroic anthropologist, really did apply. And in some senses,
it was no different here until we got.
Yeah, it wasn't any different here either. Absolutely, and basically, we started to write together as a way of arguing that tradition. But so, my doctoral work was on politics, and it was particularly looked at the nature of African politics in the colonial, post-colonial. It wasn't even called the post-colonial, it was supposedly called, what it was called at that moment. Apartheid didn't identify itself in that nomenclature, but it was in colonial and apartheid period politics. And I was concerned to look, it was several things, to re-theorize the nature of the political. My own teacher, Shapira, was the author of a particular notion of government politics and written two books on the topic, in which African politics was seen basically to be sterile. African politics was about administration, it was about order, it had nothing to do with power at all, it was about authority, which struck me fundamentally as wrong. I mean, I worked for peculiar reasons on the historical record of Tswana chiefdoms before I ever went to the field. It struck me that they operated on very different models, the models that have been basically become the orthodoxy of political anthropology. And I went to the field wanting to, as it were, take a radically different look at how power worked in pre-colonial colonial systems, and did. But of course, like Jean, I found that I was working in a world of apartheid. The leader of the opposition faction in the chieftain that I was working on happened to be national chair treasurer of the African National Congress, right? So the question became as well, how did these things interpenetrate, and how did these worlds, which anthropology since 1940, since African political systems, are treated entirely as islands and discrete unto themselves, how in the first instance those islands were built on contradictions, not on principles of order, which they were profoundly about, struggles over legitimacy, struggles over power, with active notions of the oratorical construction of competitive realities, etc., etc., and how these were dialectically entailed in worlds beyond them. That's what basically became my work. Also, by coincidence, got involved in law. I didn't intend to, but so much of the political, ironically, Jean and I always joke that the world is evolving toward Africa. In some ways it is. Many ways it is, actually. But one of the things that we see now in world politics is a kind of judicialization of the political. You know, most political disputes, contestations have graduated into the law courts. Well, this was always the case amongst Swana, right? And indeed many African polities, where a lot of what we take to be political forms of contestation occur through and in the language of legalities. And so I got interested in this and landed up, again, through an intervention of Shapira, writing a couple of papers with Simon Roberts, which led to a book and led to a sort of secondary life in the study of the law.
Now, Shapira was he was quite a straightforward ethnographer, very rich. Did he remain in your...
Very much so.
Yeah.
Until he died.
Absolutely. He read every word we wrote. Shapira was an amazing interlocutor. I mean, for a start, he had an encyclopedic grasp of Africa. I mean, I don't think, did we ever find anything he didn't know? I mean, he seemed to know everything, even until the day he died. He never forgot a damn thing. You know, you'd write a paper and you'd say, well, you know, remember that paper you wrote 25 years ago? You said something different. Why? It was very embarrassing. But he was extraordinary. The last of our work that he read, I think, other than, interestingly, the essay introducing his photographs, which was the very last thing he saw before he died, of our writing, was a Revelation Revolution. And he read through those two volumes with a fine tooth comb. Amazingly precise comments on our footnotes. You'd say, footnote 241, you've translated this. You could translate it as something else. Why don't you think about it, kind of thing. And, you know, as he got older, his handwriting got more and more. But we remained in contact.
We were always very... The families were interconnected. Yeah. And we would always visit him when we went to London. And he lived in the same room since 1948. He died in that same room.
No, he moved just before he died.
They moved him down to the corridor below. Exactly. But it was the same section of the same hotel in London that went through many instantiations, from being a kind of, you know, sort of for kind of gentlemen scholars to a place which became a kind of glitzy, sort of not quite a hot pillow joint, but almost, with this one protected corridor where these elderly people lived. And his world became more and more contracted, but he kept in contact through various connections with the entire Southern African anthropological world. And everybody was anybody went on pilgrimage, and you would call him and he would say, He always drank whiskey throughout the day and night, and he would tell you what to bring, and ham sandwiches and white bread, and you brought it, and at a certain hour you knocked and you came in.
Of the first 20 years, you more or less knew.
And you would spend, but you always had to do him the courtesy, and then he would relay the gossip of what was going on in this large diaspora, and then you would tell him what you were doing. You and your students, and students of ours went to see him and so on. But he remained, I mean, it's interesting, you are right, he was a kind of militant, almost as being put it, theoretical empiricist. But he was a very interesting person along with us, because there were certain things he rejected early on. And that is what's so interestingly connected to the style of his photography. For him, photography at one level was just another extension of the clarifying, purifying, political, empirical eye. But at the same time, it was an unblinking gaze, and he was very suspicious of people who were eager to create kind of models that were based on exclusion. He was very, very suspicious of the overly systemic structural functionist notions of tradition, for instance. And in his writing and in his photography, the world of the surrounding colonial labor market, for instance, you know, the impact of Depression era Southern Africa on local peoples always bled in. Right? And so there was a sense that the empiricism was a form of critical watch, as it were, on certain sorts of flights of theoretical fantasy. Yeah. He was very uncomfortable with theory, to him it was a mode of dishonesty. But along with that went a view that was very open to the idea that these were hybridizing dialectically sort of entailed worlds, that in fact, you know, that you had to understand the nature of migrant labor, that Africans were writing letters and they were learning to operate with new genres, and that they were entailed in complicated ways with colonialism. There was a small eye for detail. He would keep the stock records of colonial traders, so that when we went back and tried to trace the life of the commodity as one of the ways of thinking about the colonization of life worlds in among the Tswana, Shapiro had kept all of these things.
Yeah.
Which colors of blankets were sent to Bechuanaland, as it then was, to which traders, which ones were bought and which ones were sent home and why? What colours did women not like to buy? What images did they not like? So those small details, he had an instinct for the fact that they were significant. And there was a kind of material groundedness about the way he saw the world. It was also linked to a kind of big man theory of history. He did the history of chiefs and particular tribal innovators and so on. But it was a very interesting clarifying. It was also a practice theory in a way. It was not theorised in that way, but that was very much where the centre of gravity was. You looked at what people did. And from there you found the concepts you needed to explain them. And you never closed your gaze.
And that's right.
Prematurely.
That's actually an acute observation, because it's interesting. Although he objected to theory, he never objected to our writing theory as long as we demonstrated a fealty to the ethnographic. Yeah, he would cross-question us about an ethnographic practice and really cross-question us. And he'd get cross if we didn't have answers for him. But in a way, if he felt that we knew what we were talking about, the rest was okay.
And if it was clarified.
Yeah.
The most poignant moment in our relationship to him was this, was that he was always in love with these pictures. And in a way, the pictures spoke more clearly than he could. He was a very shy man. His father had committed suicide when he was quite a young man. He'd had a very strange and unrequited personal history. And so he was always more of an observer. I always felt he was a bit like a kind of Lewis Carroll figure. You know, he looked in and he was more comfortable with women and children. It was not a voyeuristic thing. He just felt easier, because also he'd been locked out of those kinds of intimacies as a child, right? And the pictures said more than he could. There was a tenderness in the pictures that he was never able to express directly. He was always gruff. So he'd always had these pictures. When his life became smaller and smaller in this tiny room, he gave away his books. He gave away everything but the pictures.
Extremely generous person.
And the pictures he would send on Christmas or New Year, he would send you a picture, a photograph. And it was usually connected in some way to what your work was and his. But he gave them out slowly and sparingly, but he was like giving of himself, as it were. And he always said he wanted to have these pictures published in some connection. And he started talking to an editor in Germany about this project. And that editor first got in touch with us and said, look, could you write an introduction to this
Shapiro
volume?
Shapiro said that he wanted us to write the introduction.
Yeah, that's right. I think Shapiro had cued him in. And so we started working, and eventually there were so many problems getting the copyright. He'd given us the copyright of some of these pictures somewhere with the Royal Anthropological Institute. Anyway, to make a long story short, it fell through with a German publisher. And we picked up the project. Shapiro was then in his mid to late 90s. But he so much wanted this book to come out. And before we'd finally settled the copyright matter, we wrote the essay. And we wrote it in Derbyshire in England, where we spent a lot of our time. And we wrote it, we took a certain liberty because we wrote about photography and empiricism and so on. But we also wrote about him and what we thought the camera told us about him that he had not said about himself. And we sent it to him when we were finished.
We were nervous as hell.
Because, you know, there were references to Susan Sontag, and we thought, oh my God, he's not going to like this. And we came really back in this shaky hand, came back this, you know, very short note, which said, you've shown me something about myself and my work that I never fully understood. You've made an old man very happy.
It was very touching.
And then, of course, he was very thrilled about this, but then he died before we finally got all the permissions together. But it came out.
It was one of our lifelong struggles, getting that blooming book. It took us, in the end, about 15 years, I think, to actually get that book.
It was like a detective story. In the end, students of ours were doing field work in Botswana, went and spoke to people in the Botswanan archives, and finally it got together.
And it was actually a labour of pure love because, you know, the photographs were eminently worth publishing. There's no question about that. But when I look back over it, had we known, I think, what it would take to do it, we never started. It was an enormous battle, and it turned out that nobody was, well, in the end, the RAI was very helpful, but there were so many obstacles in our way along the way. It was awful. But that moment made it all worthwhile. It was really, really poignant. I hope that at 95, if I'm alive, which is unlikely, I'll be able to tell a student that they taught me something I didn't know about myself.
He was a very generous person. I mean, strangely ungenerous in some ways and very generous in others.
He could be, boy, he could be very tough as hell. Yeah. But the one thing that I think is important, as far as we were concerned, is that in respect of our work, it, from the start, gave us an enormous sense of respect for the ethnographic detail. Over the 40 years or whatever we've been doing this, we've written very different kinds of things. But the one thing that the sort of spectral voice of Shapira in our heads, along with Monica, who's the same, was never lose sight of the ethnographic. And, you know, many of our theory-oriented friends and colleagues, not necessarily in anthropology, but everywhere, say, well, you know, the notion of grounded theory doesn't make any sense. To us, it's the only thing that does make sense. And often we've been taken to task for obsession with detail, you know, how the interpretive weight we put on a single detail, a few details. But ultimately, I think Shapira was right. You know, his mantra was that he would like to be remembered, not as a theorist, but like somebody like Gibbon, who wrote Samuel Pepys, or Gibbon, who really wrote a history or really captured a moment in all its fullness. And Maya Fortas once said, just in joking before he died, said, you know, that when they write the history of anthropology, I may write two or three lines, each one line, he didn't like each, of course, two lines, and Shap will write pages because he's the one person who's produced a record of a people that is absolutely unparalleled.
And it's of great use. I mean, you see, for instance, in Tswana courts,
in
Tswana churches, that they use his handbook. Yeah. It's quite a remarkable thing to see them pulling out the ethnographic record as a guide to what the tradition was.
Yes. And as a result, I mean, you could argue with his work in really, really interesting ways, because you could actually take it and say, well, you know, this can be read in three, four different ways. So what are the stakes in reading it differently? Which, of course, is an enormous tribute. I don't think anybody writes ethnography anymore that you could really take and reinterpret solidly from a different theoretical perspective. It was an extraordinary tradition.
How would you say that you, since things were changing so quickly and have changed over the course of the years that you've been doing fieldwork, and you, as you pointed out, were in a borderland to start with, there was no kind of solid, this is where you do kinship and economics and power, kind of, how do you think that you've dealt with the question of delivering a solid ethnographic record at the same time that you were coping with the theoretical?
Differently.
Yeah,
very differently. Because the sense that there was a bounded world which was reasonably self-evidently territorial and constrained to cover, the Khatla, you know, the Tswana, was compromised from the moment that we got to the field. I mean, it was compromised, some would say always, right? But the fact was, when we got to the field, it was already impossible, which is why, for instance, one of the first long stories we did was included both the English missionaries and the Tswana. Now, that's an act of hubris. Right? We are not English historians, we're not English sociologists. And there were many historians who were very unhappy with that kind of leap. Right? Who were we to be able to open up this field on both sides of the dialectic? What did we really know about those archives? But that complicated the question of what constituted the field, the different kind of levels of scale that were relevant or pertinent to any particular problem. And so, in a sense, that idea of total coverage was less viable in the sense that Shapira understood it. Yeah. It was never our goal. However, biting down deeply enough into a particular terrain so that you really understood or thought you had some understanding of what was going on was still the job, was still the project. So that if one was writing about the nonconformist missionaries from the north of England in the early 19th century, you really had the job not only to read their letters and to read the history and that has been written about that world, and to read the local newspapers, and to read the tunes that were going around, and the kind of the abolitionist songs and all those kinds of things, to get a sense of the texture of their world. But you had to also do that on the South African side. Now, it is true that we've shifted. I mean, we've experimented with all kinds of work. There was a sense and a time in which looking at the national level in South Africa became key. And at least in terms of our understanding of a responsibility to a world, even a region, and what seemed to be the important issues at the time. And so you try to get a sense of, a responsible sense of the world about which you're speaking, which is not the same as doing a kind of grounded ethnography where you speak to all the headmen, which is the way, I mean, Shapira exhaustively moved across the terrain, and you have these pictures of him sitting in the chiefly meeting place, in a three-piece suit with his legs crossed in his notebook, and all of the members of the chiefly council are on the ground, and he goes from one to the other, and he exhaustively takes the genealogy. It's not the kind of world one is dealing with.
Although, can I say something about that, though? Because I think that we tend to look at what we've done over the years from now rather than from its point of origin. But our early work, at least it was never traditional in the sense of trying to do an ethnography of a people, but it was very deeply grounded in what anthropologists do. I mean, we collected genealogies until they came out of our ears. We could have, discourse for hours on father's brother's daughter marriage, and this has been, matrilateral.
Oh, yeah. Apprenticed with a traditional healer.
Yeah, we did all that stuff.
I mean, all of that we did.
And in a way, we took it as very important because we figured that if we were going to play at the edges and make arguments for historical anthropology, for some of the later stuff that we've done, which is much further from classical anthropology, one had to do conventional anthropology well, otherwise nobody take it seriously. And I'm still perfectly happy to think back over the work we've done, stuff like bride wealth and cattle economies and things like that, because that really, it's very much like being a jazz musician out of classical tradition. You either can play your scales or you can't, right? And we learned to play those scales because we had teachers who really demanded and demanded it well. I mean, we were very privileged. Shapira, Monica Wilson, Gina Fontaine later, all of whom really pushed us to do and to master. And they were very respectful of what we did in the end, I think, especially Gina in later times. But they pushed us very hard.
But the difficulty now is to know what the scales are.
Ah, absolutely.
See, this is the problem.
This is 40 years on.
And that is the issue, is how one keeps faith with that, the kind of insight and the kind of humility in front of the ethnographic. I think the thing that I find most, and in our arguments with historians and literary theorists and so on, the thing about, and it's difficult if you're committed to a certain kind of radical view of the world. I mean, we do believe in large unfolding processes. A lot of our work has been about capitalism as its consequences, modernity and its meanings in different places, its realizations. But at the same time, how you actually keep faith with the fact that the ethnographic tells you don't know all the questions until you go. The world can surprise you. There may be a large picture, there may be a large theory, but the way that it's actually happening, the course that it takes, is never totally foreclosed and overdetermined. And to be able to do that when you're asking other kinds of questions, the questions that to us seem to be important, after the end of apartheid, for instance. Why was it when people expected discourses of democracy, that an obsession with crime and the occult overtook the popular imagination and was very viable and tangible in the field where we did our field work, but our field work, the people who we looked at then, were now liberated South Africans who could move all over the map and didn't simply sit put. And they moved up the scale and they moved across the geographical terrain. And how did you map the life of those ideas and their significance, and where did you find the equivalent of the scales there? And that has been the challenge. It's an exciting challenge, but it's a difficult one, and that's what we've described in that one paper we published called Ethnography on an Awkward Scale, right? Because it's this question of what is the scale and where do you find density? And where do you save yourself from falling into the trap of a certain kind of cultural analysis that takes topoi from here or there, or texts from here or there, you know, or op-ed pieces, and presumes the connective tissue, and writes beautiful things about particular little, you know, fragments, but doesn't subscribe to the anthropological hubris of the whole. That you can never do that, but that sense of a responsibility for the connections and for the extensions and the totalizing vision is very important, I think. And that's hard to do in the world in which we live.
And you know, coupled with that, I think, importantly, is I think an anthropological obligation to avoid its own irrelevance. Yes. We live in an age in which retreat from theory has become a retreat into rank empiricism, not into the empirical
or difference,
but into an empiricism that doesn't actually take on the problems and the challenges of grounded theory, but also really renders itself irrelevant, either by making very complex phenomena into culture, as Jean says, or simply avoiding the really difficult questions about the contemporary moment in the world, about what is happening to the impact of late capital on the worlds that we work among. Our concept, I mean, we just finished a book called Ethnicity, Inc. Why? Because culture is no longer what anthropologists thought it was. You know, culture is now part of the market. It's a commodity, as it has always been, but in ways that one can no longer avoid. It's now possession. It's possession that is negotiated by those who possess it, and indeed who claim all kinds of legal rights for it. The sort of notion of islands beyond history simply doesn't exist anymore. It hasn't ever, of course, but in the neoliberal moment, it presents itself with real force. After all, many of the things that we thought were units of analysis no longer bear any scrutiny at all. And a lot of anthropology has avoided the question by retreating into that form of empiricism. To us, that makes the discipline irrelevant. And, you know, we both argued very strongly for the fact that anthropology ought not ever to have been, and certainly should not now, be defined by some kind of preordained idea of a subject matter. It's not what we study, it's how we study it. So we have students now working on policing in India. Computer hacking in America, and all kinds of stuff.
British banking.
Yeah, I mean, you name it, they're studying it. Doesn't matter what it is. The beauty of it, it's mainly very interesting, and it's very contemporary. What the anthropological dimension of it is a particular way of thinking about those problems, of estranging them, of not treating the ways in which those phenomena are lived as the conceptual repertoire through which they're to be understood, i.e. they become the problems, not the ways we address the problem. So ethnicity is not an analytic category. It's a thing in the world that has to be explained by virtue of other analytic categories. And in that way, the anthropological capacity to estrange, to decompose and deconstruct surfaces in order to explain them, I think is what this is about. And that really does have to do with a kind of courage, simultaneous courage and humility in the face of the moment. We live in a very complex moment, but we can neither avoid it nor allow it simply to be treated at face value, unless we do too much.
Yeah, I think one of the other issues is this, and it's a problem that we struggle with quite a lot in our recent work, is that it's simultaneously a commitment to the sense that the manifestations of big processes are always particular, grounded, mediated in complicated ways, and they need to be recognized, and they also have to be grounded in the subjectivity of actors. And I think that's another thing that anthropology brings, is a kind of phenomenology, right? Is that you always assume that human beings may not make history exactly as they please, but they try to make it somewhat as they please, right? So there is a kind of agentive, and that's something that we engage in people's consciousness and so on. But at the same time, and that implies very particular local kinds of, and you work hard to know a place and to have the right to kind of write about it. But at the same time, there are family resemblances, there are global processes, and those of us, and I think, you know, both of you share this, is that we live simultaneously in several parts of the world. We live half the year in South Africa. We spend lots of time in England where we taught and students, and we live here. And what you see there, I mean, these are all areas of advanced capitalist modernity, but the formations in each place are different. You know? They're singular. And so the relationship between the similarity and the difference is very important. You know? At the same time, it's moments like this where you see how, for instance, crises, you know, have impacts that require that you talk comparatively over a large span of time. What is neoliberalism, for instance, you know, that much abused and much debated construct? How do we begin to ask questions that enable us to see that there are things going on in South Africa, England, and now that look very similar? And somehow one has to be able to do justice to the particularity of a grounded understanding, but also see those bigger questions, not only about difference, it's not only about distinctiveness, it's not only about it's more complicated or they do it differently there. And anthropology has too easily allowed itself to take that kind of line. And be very suspicious of looking at similarity, particularly globally connected similarities, simple determinations. But they imply that we have to look at those broad pictures and say it's not only about the distinctiveness, but it's about things that are affecting the world and affecting places differently depending on where they sit on what is a single kind of structured landscape. And I think that's very
important. Yeah, and the courage to theorize, I think, is crucial. The courage to theorize critically. I mean, we ran into this after 1994 when we wrote about occult economies, the rise of witchcraft after the end of apartheid. And it was very clear to us that the forms of witchcraft epidemic, witch killings in South Africa, had a great deal to do with rising unemployment and with the impact of structural adjustment on the South African countryside, etc., etc. When we first published this work, several anthropologists said, this is ridiculous, it's all about local relations, it's about local hatreds and local this and that. Now, trivially, that was correct. Of course it was about local things, but those local things don't end. The chains of determination at the local. It's no mistaking that many of the people who have been killed in the context of who have been killed in the context of these witch killings were killing people because they believed that they had taken jobs away, etc. We kept insisting that there was a hinterland that required explanation here. A lot of anthropologists said no, stop at the local. Well, yeah, but that's exactly what confines anthropology to irrelevance.
But there was also an issue that linked the other thing we were saying was that advanced capitalism at this point had seen the entering in of the occult and the speculative in many domains that were kind of equivalents elsewhere of the very evident witchcraft phenomena in Southern Africa, right? Mm-hmm. So that things like Ponzi schemes and pyramid schemes going on here, the rise of certain kinds of religious enchanted movements, the debate about various forms of spectrality and speculation, were part of a moment that had to do with the changing relationship between space, production, nation, and people's understandings of value. And that meant that we took some very wild leaps. Making the point that, you know, there were arguments about whether something like witchcraft, which has always been understood in terms of the minutiae of precisely those kinds of kinship relations and tensions, contradictions we were talking about later, could also be local mediations or refractions of larger scale sort of shifts, tectonic shifts in the political and economic and cultural universe in which people live. But we also argued that, and we started out that paper on occult economies with which we had quite a sort of well-versed argument with Sally Moore, for instance, about the nature of theory and evidence, that in fact you were seeing in structurally equivalent places, like in Russia, for instance, you were seeing things that were the equivalent, in terms of which there seemed to be the entry into not only... there were both specters and speculation in the way in which the market seemed to be working, because people could not quite understand how value was moving, why suddenly some people were becoming wealthy and others not. What was the magic of this form of free market they kept hearing about, and the reality of their accessibility to these things. And so we argued that there were similarities that you couldn't ignore, even although they weren't simply comparable. Now, that's not always a safe and popular move to make. Yeah. But that sort of thing I think anthropologists should think about. Yeah. I mean, we said, think about cargo cults, which is where our connection all the way back to Peter Worsley came. Think about cargo cults and the way in which people are building warehouses in parts of the new economic frontier, hoping that business will come and land. Or villages in Africa where you say, please, will the tourists come to our village, not the next one, we're going to lay everything there so that we hope that there will be takeoff. So there were things there that we wanted to bring together that people
Precisely took the anthropological tradition, the classical tradition, and said, okay, how does one make sense of it in the historical moment of the here and now? And how Monica Wilson and Godfrey wrote a famous book about social change, where they talk about scale is one of the great anthropological problems. And this is what we're dealing with, really, that the scale of the occult had expanded. I mean, we were being told by our own informants, the difference between Satanism and witchcraft was that Satanism was global. It was about space-time compression.
This high octane model.
High octane, yeah, exactly. So our informants were telling, they were providing theories that our colleagues at the London School of Economics wouldn't hear, right? Whatever happened to native voice, it got sort of fetishized and lost. Because if the natives don't say what you want, of course, it becomes a bit of a problem. But the point that Jean's made, which is very powerful, is that it's precisely this, the adoption of the classical tradition into asking questions about estrangement, that take phenomena that don't seem as though they're the same, and are interestingly both similar and different, that raise questions that allow an anthropological imagination to answer them, even though they spread way beyond the scale of this one. And that actually led us to an edited volume on millennial capitalism, where we made the argument that understanding capitalism was very much about understanding the old issue of millennialism in the ways that anthropologists had understood it before, right? But expanded into the moment, expanded into literally the year 2000, where it was capitalism itself that became salvific. That, as it were, the temporality of the moment, the shift of the millennium, and the millennial sense that capitalism would deliver salvation, as it did promise, in the year 2000. After all, it was that gave us the Bush administration and this extraordinary faith in deregulating everything. The market would solve everything, which it was occultic and salvific a movement that one could imagine. History's going to look back at and say, why didn't anthropology understand this from way back? Because it really was an anthropological problem.
The interesting thing was that Jeremy Cronin, who's the Deputy Secretary of the South African Communist Party, but also a Member of Parliament and a noted poet, wrote a wonderful poem about the kind of, it was really about a millennial movement in the Eastern Cape that happened on the dawn of overrule in the
19th century.
Yes, but I'm thinking exactly when. But anyway, in the Eastern Cape in South Africa, it was about killing cattle so that the millennium would arrive. And what he did was he used that as a parallel for the current moment of market takeoff. And this was just at the point where the likes of Mbeki were saying, the real solution in South Africa has to be, ultimately, in tune with market neoliberalism. And so he was, just after we'd written this book, he used this image, and he didn't read anthropology, he's got much more significant things to do. But that same image, and that's what is interesting, is the sense that you really are dealing with something which is a worldwide movement or worldwide epochal sort of development that settles differently in different places, but is connected, its logic is connected.
Which is, by the way, it's interesting. I think that we'll look back on the extraordinary effervescence surrounding the Obama election in America as a profoundly anthropological moment. That is to say, one that is better understood through Durkheim and through our knowledge of a particular form of social effervescence and the way these congeal into what look like social movements but are moments of deep populism, much better than we will understand it through an orthodox political analysis or economic analysis. So in a way, the plea for anthropology, not merely to leave the reservation, but to lose its reservations about confronting the contemporary, seems the only way that we're going to save ourselves from crashing irrelevance. And one sees in all kinds of places, the various new anthropologies that declare themselves, the anthropology of Christianity, the anthropology of this, the anthropology of that, seem to be motivated by an impulse to shrink back into an anthropology which is either profoundly cultural or profoundly localizing. Whereas to me and to Jean as well, I think, this seems to be really the death of the discipline lies in, as it were, a reproductive impulse rather than a productive engagement with the critical edges of the world we live in. It's ironic because, as we say, if anthropology is about estrangement, it is strange to us that anthropology is resisting estrangement. Our students, of course, our student generation are doing extraordinary things, but they still run into difficulties. They still run into difficulties in some contexts.
But I think some of the work, for instance, that you yourself have been part of, Cameron, for Global Pharmaceuticals.
Now that's
important. Or the ways in which you can track into particular intersections. like, for instance, you know, global pharmaceuticals, whether it's in the marketing or the testing or whatever, that there are intersections there that enable you to do really interesting things. And anthropologists have worked very well with those, using their own models and moving beyond.
No, I think that's true. I think that's true. I had much more in mind, not so much the more interesting critical edges of American anthropology, but much more British, European and Commonwealth anthropology, which seems much more wedded.
European anthropology is going through a renaissance.
Well,
it's very interesting.
The
European Anthropological Association is flexing its muscles in very interesting ways, and that's fascinating because people from different language traditions come together.
Maybe.
You know, and I mean, in Germany, for instance, I mean, there are lots of places on the continent where, in fact, people who are interested in things like global humanitarianism and NGOs, I mean, they're things. The danger there, though, is that it can become disengaged from the kind of grounded ethnography that we started talking
about. Yeah, it's a question I would ask you about in training your students. You yourselves, because of who you are and the circumstances in which you set out, were able to successfully take on both sides of the dialectic, as you put it earlier. Mm-hmm. But you need a license to do that.
Exactly.
That's quite a lot to hand to a graduate student to undertake, even if you think it's the most important and current challenge.
It's a very difficult thing. Look, even if you think of the career of our graduate students, I mean, when it comes to teaching theory, for instance, we now start at Augustine, we go through the whole of the Western philosophical tradition, we do anthropology, we go into literary theory. Right? When they put their exam lists together, when I first arrived at this university, only anthropological texts, and we would argue about, you know, ancestors like Weber. He didn't really, Durkheim, yes, Weber, not so sure, you know. Now, I mean, the whole of the Western philosophical, you know, people will get into Spinoza because he's had a real impact on the Nietzscheans who write about affect and Carl Schmitt. And there are anthropology lists that have very little anthropology on at all. Or if they do, they've got to have everything else. They've got to be responsible for everything. And there are things to be said for a certain limited disciplinarity, you know. In a way, you can only be transdisciplinary if you have some sense of discipline to start with. It's very hard to know. Now, I think the burden of what we've been saying is it's more a mode of approach and a kind of, I think at basis, anthropology's identity was laid in practice, in a certain ethnographic kind of practice, right? And so, you know, I mean, one has extended the idea of what practice involves back to Marx, back to other kinds of pragmatists, William J., whatever. But when it comes to theory, it's difficult to know how you can be responsible to all of that and still have a sense of mastery of a particular craft. And then when it comes to field work, it's extremely difficult because people work in fields that, you know, that and the difficulty is to, you know, have the bounded system but the openness to the idea of the full range, if you like, of forces and factors and flows that produce the local that you're looking at, it, to use Arjun Upadhyay's terms, right? Mm-hmm. And how you get that sensitivity with a sense that you can carve out a piece that speaks meaningfully to these larger processes and problems. That's very difficult to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And often it's not just, sometimes it involves archival work to be able to understand why, you know, a free trade zone, you know, in northern Namibia appears when it does and why the Chinese there selling German designer kitchens, right? Yeah. That sort of problem, which are real problems that are being researched right now. Where do you begin? You have to be responsible to very large bodies of reading, knowledge, and theoretical conceptualization to be able to find that little place before you go there.
And we struggle with it. I mean, in this sense, there isn't an answer to the question. There are answers that each piece of work with each student and each project actually struggles to find out. That, to me, I think, is, again, the creative possibility of anthropology, that we actually engage with those questions. Sometimes the answers are more successful than they are at other times. There's no doubt about that. But the degree to which one sticks with a model of the discipline, predicated, as we said, on estrangement, etc., that is tied to a dialectic of the inductive and the deductive, that constantly says, what is the ethnographic problem that I or we want to address? What is the theoretical and conceptual frame that is commensurate to that problem? Mm. How then do I design a methodology that can convince anybody other than myself, my parents and my dog, that this actually is convincing?
The SSRC
or committee or peers, i.e., and we constantly say to our students, tell us why we should believe that your ethnography leads to the conclusion or the solution to the problem that you're positing.
And why should we be interested?
And why should we be interested, exactly, which was an old Max Lapin question.
Why should we be interested in your work? Fixation. Right.
That it's your duty to tell us, not our duty to figure it out. And your duty to tell the world. That's one of the reasons our students actually do quite well in the world, because they're faced with that question from day one. But the notion of commensuration of the dialectic of the inductive and the deductive, of method to claim, of problem to solution, of argumentation, of a fealty to the detail, seems to us to be the only sort of abstract way of formulating an answer to a question which is always answered in the practice. So you can't tell, before the event, I mean, we constantly go through exercises with our students. How are you going to convince the SSRC? What sorts of commentary? How are you actually going to tell us how rogue sociality works amongst diamond miners in Angola? Tell us, what are you going to look for? What is it actually going to look like? When you're there, who are you going to talk to and how? And then how are you going to convince us that the conversations or whatever the data was ought to tell us about the construct that you're developing to explain this phenomenon?
You know, also we're talking here as if it were the two of us and our students.
That's everybody.
I mean, we have worked in this university, the University of Chicago, which is an extraordinary place. I mean, we travel the world, we've been to many places.
Is much bigger than the two of us.
There's no place like this for a series of, you know, historical reasons. It's not only people, it's the place, it's just, you know, the coming together on the south side of Chicago in a very condensed space. It's a very sort of intense, and sometimes overwhelmingly so, environment. But one of the things that has developed there is a very strong sense of the craft of anthropology and our sense of responsibility as teachers.
Yeah.
We all love teaching and we feel it as a calling, as it were. And we've designed a set of courses, from theoretical courses to methods courses to research design courses, where we actually hammer out
all of these things.
These are required courses for the students. Right?
Every student has to go through these.
And they go through as cohorts, yeah. And they've got to learn that first of all, writing, designing research proposals is not a natural form. It doesn't come naturally to anybody. And your first efforts will be ham-fisted. And, you know, and we get a group of students at the same stage to trust each other enough and to be respectful enough to work interactively on developing their projects, right? And this is something that the department has done.
We also have workshops that do very similar.
Right, workshops, yeah. And regular seminars. Mm-hmm. We really believe in the cultures of discourse, that people have got to be around interesting arguments made anthropologically from the moment they come to university, but to graduate school in particular. So they develop a sensibility that's anthropological, and then they've got to find something in the world. Not an abstract, you're not interested, you know, in X's theory of why. You're interested in why this has happened or taken the shape it has there now. And the question is, how then do you move from that outwards to the commensurate kinds of knowledge that you need? And that's where we work with them, you know, and we go through the proposals painfully. First of all, a one-page example, you know, a statement of problem. Then you tie the method to that, and the method and the statement of the problem have to speak to each other. Then the theoretical dimensions, which literatures are drawn upon, what kinds of arguments.
It's very,
know,
very rigorous training.
Sort of,
and, you know, they have to answer. Gene has developed the mantra many years ago, which has just become a department mantra, which is, to what problem is this research an answer? And until you can actually...
What question?
To what question? What problem? Until a student can actually frame that, nobody takes it, neither their peers nor their teachers take them seriously. The other side of the workshop, this deeply socialized mode of producing anthropology, is also the implicit question always, what is the value added from an anthropological perspective? I.e.,
yeah.
What are you doing that your peers in sociology or psychology or political theory or what political science or whatever don't add? And we expect them to have an answer to that question. There must be an anthropology. Now, some students do this in very mechanical ways and some do it in very creative ways, but it's something that they internalize very, very early. And the workshop system is also an apprenticeship system. The faculty present their work, and it's chopped about as much as any students is chopped about.
Students always commentate on the faculty.
So they actually see how we're producing work, as well as being answerable to each other. And that has, I mean, it's not an egalitarian ethos, because there isn't an egalitarian ethos really in graduate teaching, but it does allow the possibility of an apprenticeship ethos, in which we're all apprentices, basically. And I don't think that we've written anything, or certainly haven't edited a book, since we've been here, 30 years, that hasn't in some sense been deeply in conversation with what our students around me and talking about. Wherever we go to other universities, people say, we want to speak to graduate students. Yes, of course we do. What questions do you have to ask? The first question we ask them is, what are you guys arguing about? Right? Because, and very often we get blank stares. Sometimes we get very creative answers. But that's what we expect our students to know. What are you arguing about? What are the real issues here? Because if you guys who are 25 to 30 aren't arguing about the world in interesting ways, believe you me, your discipline's dead.
The fascinating thing is that anthropology in some ways might indeed be, it's counter-hegemonic, it's marginal, it's threatened in many places. But the ideas from anthropology are still so generative. Yeah. Being far beyond the discipline, and everybody's doing what they call ethnography.
Yeah.
Often it just means like talking to people, right? But it's ethnography. And it's nursing, you know, accountancy. They're all ostensibly now doing, you know, ethnography. So there is still that sense that there's an extraordinary generative, productive quality of asking questions against the grain.
That's right.
You know, looking against the grain, not assuming, always never assuming the surface narrative is what's going on, right?
It's
that's the whole thing.
George Marcus wrote a paper some time, not very long ago. So it's actually a very, very interesting paper, very thoughtful piece. In which he says, you know, it's about basically the future of anthropology. He says, look, you know, institutionally anthropology is doing fine. Most of the big departments are thriving, et cetera, et cetera. We're getting more and more undergraduate enrollments, which is true. But he said what concerned him was that we become, he doesn't use the term, but we become a parasite discipline in the sense that we weren't producing our own theory, that we were evoking post-colonial studies, critical feminism, et cetera, et cetera. And he gave an interesting list. I actually think the opposite is true in some respects, that an enormous proportion of discourses in other disciplines are actually looking to anthropology for all kinds of inspiration. I mean, for example...
Not grand theory,
because there isn't much grand theory
grand
around.
Grand theory is a generic product of the social...
Well, exactly.
Human sciences, anyway.
It doesn't come from any discipline.
It doesn't come from any particular...
But, certainly not. But the fact is that, I mean, when you look at, for example, recent stuff in law and society, the impact of anthropology is enormous. Look at the new strain of the cultural study of politics and political theory. A tremendous debt to anthropology, and the ethnographic sensibility, as Jean says, is everywhere. And these days, you know, you can't have a respectable department of anything without ethnography. So I don't think that we've got anything to be particularly concerned about in that respect. What we have to be concerned about is the acuity of our questions in interrogating this very puzzling world we live in. We've said before, an age of revolution, which we only dimly understand, and for which we're only dimly beginning to construct a discursive repertoire.
And it's about South Africa, because you say you're spending about half the year there every year. So there's both the community of people you refer to who were and are South African anthropologists, and then also the research and the continuation of the research with the specific kinds of problems relevant to South Africa. So how would you say you're moving that trajectory forward?
The story is that we have large numbers of students who work in Southern Africa and in Africa, although the biggest proportion of our students don't. Mm. I mean, so we're both very invested in that region. But we're also very keen to see that region invest in anthropology that is not just parochial, right? That is more global, will take on wider sorts of issues. And we take an undergraduate group there every year. But since the end of apartheid, during the apartheid years, there was a boycott, an academic boycott called by the ANC, and we respected it. We didn't have much to do with the universities during that time, although we visited our families there. But afterwards, we went back and got very involved in various kinds of projects to try and get the social sciences up and running again after a period of incredible, you know, sort of undermining during the apartheid years. And we've been going back ever since, both to do that, to work in various contexts, reviewing departments, participating in the training of students, having students coming over here and spending time with us and doing postdocs, having our students there and so on, but also doing our own research, which we always, our first... sort of engagement with critical feedback on our own work is always in South Africa at the various universities.
And we have ongoing research projects, and we're doing now a major project on crime and policing, and we will probably follow up our Ethnicity Inc. book with another study of the same phenomenon among the so-called Bushmen, the San, and some Tswana peoples also involved in the sort of new political economy of identity. So we have ongoing research all the time. In addition to our 24 students we take there every year for 11 weeks, as Jean says, I engage with the university. We're both honorary professors at University of Cape Town. We have close links with WITS, Institute for Social and Economic Research, WISER, which we've actually been involved in as kind of friendly outsiders from the very beginning.
And for the first time now, two of our PhD students have taken up, you know, assistant professorships and are writing papers about, you know, rethinking, reimagining anthropology in Southern Africa now, which is really exciting.
Yeah, it's very exciting. So we see basically Chicago anthropology being implanted in South Africa with students
being
who came from South Africa, but being remade in a very, you know, we've got a pit project, which is basically called Theory from the South. And the argument of the project as a general thing is that for, 200 years, the social sciences have believed the theories produced in the North and the data comes from the South. Well, we and our students collectively think that the world has turned over, that interesting theories coming from the South and the North is becoming more a source of at least comparative data. And this younger generation, who are incredibly smart and wonderfully able, are putting their own stamp on that kind of issue. They're very independent minded, because we don't ever want our students
to come from all kinds of backgrounds.
Yeah.
Yeah. Black and white, Afrikaans, English speaking.
Gay,
it's
straight,
really
male, female, you name it, there it is.
Yeah.
But for us, it's a great matter of pride to see our students basically, you know, go it alone, become an independent new generation, thinking new thoughts, doing new things. The last thing we've ever wanted our students to do is what we do. And I must say, they do us proud in exceeding us in all kinds of ways. So we have, you know, ongoing connections there. And of course, lots of our friends who left South Africa roughly the time that we did, who are now back, we're part of a very lively network of scholars and
beyond the academy.
Yeah,
that's the
academy.
Other thing, the relationship between the academy and the public world in South Africa is much more porous. So when we're there, we're much more involved in public debate, newspaper debate. We have friends who are in Parliament who are very involved in advising the new kind of political movements that are emerging right now as we speak and so on. And, you know, we've done everything from being involved in kind of hip-hop collectives that wanted to read social theory to
advising constitutional court.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's a very different kind of much more sort of immediately engaged world, and one of incredible possibility and great hazards. Yeah.
But enormous dynamism.
But,
enormous dynamism.
Amazing public debate.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we can't sit, you know, we have our usual haunts. We can't go to breakfast in our local place without half a dozen people at the table within 10 minutes arguing about whatever's going on in politics that day. It's that kind of society. Everybody's listening to the radio, everybody's
taking sides.
And they're
very interested in culture.
Yeah.
This is the thing that for years anthropology, you know, was the colonizing pariah discipline. Mm-hmm. But with the kind of reanimation of culture, for good or ill, as a site of claims and identity, right? Anthropology is very chic, right?
Yeah,
and the large numbers of black South Africans who want to learn anthropology and want to have anthropological engagement with their own cultural projects and so on. So that's another interesting moment.
Being approached and asked to join in conversations about the broadest sets of things. It's really, really interesting. There's a sense of respect that anthropology actually has something to say to public discourse. It's no longer any form of pariah, I mean, quite the opposite. The legal profession, for the first time, is engaging seriously with legal anthropology. In the newspapers, our colleague and friend, our dear friend, Steve Robbins, is a major op-ed writer in the local papers. And
he's a professor of anthropology.
Yeah, and he writes really serious, good stuff. I mean, so there's an enormous amount of sense that this is, and you know, when the Bushmen, San, they call themselves Bushmen in Botswana, San in South Africa, engage in their land claims case, their human rights lawyer consultant, whose daughter, interestingly, was doing an anthropology degree, was consulting Steve and various other anthropologists, Kees van der Waal also, from Stellenbosch University, on how this kind of politics is going to take shape in South Africa. So this constant vibrancy, constant sense of engagement, land claims. A lot of anthropologists are engaged, not in the old sort of applied anthropology sense, but in an ongoing public discourse about what ought to be happening.
Medical ethics. I mean, I've been teaching for 3 years with Solly Beneteau, who's a medical ethicist and former head of the medical school at UCT. And we have a course on things you've worked on yourself, which is, you know, what should be the approach of global pharmaceuticals wanting to do research in Southern Africa? What kind of human subject protection, what kind of political constraint should be placed on profiteering in South Africa, which is a very desirable research destination, but also a vulnerable one. And that's where they call in anthropologists, and you work with people who sit on these committees and so on, and debate the nature of, you know, the sort of global, cultural, political issues in Boxer.
And undergraduates picking up on that. I volunteer for TAC, for TAC Treatment Action Campaign, and AIDS activism, for Bush Radio, a community radio station. They teach it at a local township school. They do all kinds of stuff. Some of them volunteer at the Institute for Security Studies and do large-scale survey work for them. Others in work on in sort of philanthropy and stuff. They just get engaged because, again, there's a sense that this is a world of engagements.